Welcome to the Better Together podcast, brought to you by the Emergency Services Foundation.
This is a podcast dedicated to supporting and improving the mental health and well-being of the many people, paid and volunteer, who serve our community in emergency management roles.
My name is Susan McKenzie, CEO at the Emergency Services Foundation.
And I'm Sarah Hewitt, Project Manager for the ESF Learning Network.
Today we're speaking with Erin Smith, who's just taken a position as CEO of the Dart Centre for Journalism and Trauma Asia Pacific. She was formerly Associate Professor in Disaster and Emergency Response at Edith Cowan University. Erin writes a monthly column that will be known to many of you called Let's Talk Mental Health for the Australian Emergency Services magazine. And she was a guest presenter at ESF's Leading for Better Mental Health pilot program.
Thanks for having me. It's lovely to be here with you both, Susan and Sarah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Erin. Thanks so much for joining us. Let's start by asking, how did you develop your passion for emergency response work?
Do you know what? It was about 20 years ago, and I actually started out my career as being a 000 call taker for ambulance when it was Intergraph way back then, even before it was ESTAR. So even before all of my current work, I really had a passion for helping out the community in an emergency services role, answering calls for help with 000.
Wow, that goes way back. And what about your earlier research? Where did the research interest begin?
Well, interestingly, when I was still working as a 000 call taker, I was actually working the evening of September 11th, 2001. And as we all know, the 9/11 terrorist attacks changed our world profoundly. And I actually ended up working at Monash University not long after, helping train our paramedics at what was then called MUCAPS, which has now gone on to become a major provider of education for our paramedics here in Victoria. And long story short, I ended up going on to do a PhD, which really looked at how we could better prepare our paramedics to be involved in those mass casualty kind of situations. And it really went back to what I witnessed that night, sitting in a call taker situation, watching the 9/11 terrorist attacks unfold as I was answering 000 calls here in Melbourne, Victoria, watching something happen on the other side of the globe, but knowing in my gut that the world as we knew it had changed. And it turns out I was right. And those attacks that happened on the other side of the globe not only changed my professional career, because I would go on to actually follow a cohort of those 9/11 responders over the next two decades to see how responding to those attacks would change their lives, both physically and mentally. But it would also go on to change my life personally, because I would then go on to see firsthand the cost of bearing witness, the actual cost of being part of the response to such a huge mass casualty event. So, yeah, it just goes to show one event, one mass casualty attack can actually change somebody's life prolifically.
And what did that 9/11 study find briefly? You know, what was the impact? I mean, apart from the bleeding obvious, what was the impact on those responders?
Yeah, I think the thing that really surprised me, Susan, was just how profound it was and how long-term it was. So most recently, we did a review at the 20-year anniversary to see what was going on for those responders. And I think what surprised a lot of people was that it was over 60,000 different volunteers and paid responders ultimately played some role in responding over 8 months after those attacks. So both on the day and in the 8 months afterwards. And there's been a whole host of ongoing physical and mental health impacts. And what we've found is that those physical health impacts have increased over time. So certainly we've got the lung issues and the respiratory issues, but now we're seeing the cancers that are playing a bigger, significant role over time. And then, of course, the mental health burden is growing as well. So there's obviously the PTSD, the anxiety and depression, and then we see the suicide as well, which is a really unfortunate toll on many of the responders. And then it's the ripple effect on the families and the intergenerational impact too. So So it's, I think it's the long-term impact that none of us had really even thought about in those weeks and months after the attacks had occurred.
So, look, I know you've been to New York many times speaking with people. Surely that work must have had a huge impact on you too in terms of vicarious trauma. Is that right?
Yeah, it certainly has, Susan, and it's something I know you and I have spoken about before on an Insight conversation with ESF, so I won't go into it in as much detail as we did then, but suffice to say I certainly wasn't prepared for the impact that it would have on me personally, and it took many, many years for that impact to really rise to the surface and for me to be aware of what was happening. And I think my psychiatrist really summarised it best when he said to me that it's the cost of bearing witness. And over those years, over those two decades of hearing all the stories of the hundreds of responders that I've spoken to over the past two decades, and, you know, when I go to bed at night sometimes and the nightmares that I have, I don't know if it's me buried under the rubble or the person that I've spoken to, because I've heard so many stories that I know what it smelt like and what it felt like and what it sounded like, because I've heard so many people tell me what it was, what it felt like for them. And what I've learnt the most, I think, about vicarious trauma is that we respond the same way physiologically whether we were there or not, because our bodies and our brains can't decipher whether it was us or not. Because when we've heard that story so many times, our brain starts to think that it's our story. And so we respond physically the same way as if we were there. And so, yes, I learned a lot about vicarious trauma because I lived through that. And so I try to share my story about that to help others recognise and manage their own vicarious trauma now.
It must have been pretty unusual to have an Australian coming over doing this study in America.
Yeah, and it's been really interesting over the years, because when I first came in, it took a long time to build up trust and rapport, because exactly that, a lot of these firefighters were very hesitant. Who's this Aussie chick coming in, and why does she care, and why does she want to know? But once I got in and once they realised I was there to genuinely understand and to genuinely share their story so that we could learn from that, they let me in. And once I was part of that inner circle, I was there for good. And again, that became part of the reason I got vicariously traumatised, because I absolutely crossed that line between being researcher and research participant, and I became friends with many of these people. And so when they became sick, and then they became really sick and started to die, it absolutely devastated me, and I found it really difficult to put boundaries in place once I'd already crossed that line. So that's one of the biggest lessons I've learned, and I try to share now with my research students and people doing this kind of work, is to put firm boundaries in place right from the get-go. You know, going into people's homes and seeing how they live and seeing their uniforms and smelling those uniforms that they wore to the Ground Zero site. You know, I can't unsmell that. I can't unsee that. And they're lessons that I've learned the hard way. So they're the things that I try to share with people now about protecting themselves when it comes to doing this kind of research.
It's probably no wonder that you've had the amazing number of 560 million shares of your research. And I know it's just not on that topic, it's on other topics as well, but, you know, people are so interested in this work. What other issues have you researched and written on over the years that are close to your heart?
Yeah, so that is, yeah, that was, I was incredibly proud of that. So thank you, Susan. That was within the past 12 months alone, that was just around three of the key areas that I've researched. So that was the 9/11 research on the 20th anniversary, but some of the other key issues that I'm really, really proud of, and most recently that was the impact on our local Australian volunteer firefighters who responded to the Black Summer bushfires. And what we really wanted to get to understand there was around how we can better support their mental health and wellbeing. So 12 months on from the 2019-2020 bushfires, we interviewed about 60 volunteer firefighters, and they were predominantly from Victoria and New South Wales. And we wanted to get a really good idea as to what kind of impact responding to those bushfires had on their mental health and wellbeing, and whether they felt adequately supported by the organisations that they were volunteering for.
And what did you find?
So overwhelmingly, we found that sadly, they all felt quite profoundly impacted in terms of their mental health and well-being. And in a nutshell, that really ranged from some of them had quite fleeting symptoms. So, you know, trouble sleeping, feeling a little bit anxious, to really ongoing post-traumatic stress symptoms that had then gone on to being post-traumatic stress disorder or post-traumatic stress injury. So they really, there was that quite broad spectrum there. And what was really the biggest takeaway for us in terms of the lesson was that they really did not feel supported in terms of mental health and wellbeing by their organisations. Some of the key takeaways for us was that the main type of support that was offered was these external EAPs or employee assistance programs. And while they can certainly play a role in supporting wellbeing, the people that we spoke to felt that on their own they weren't enough, and certainly when they were only offered, and some of the services only offered three free sessions, and some of the people we spoke to said, come on, that's not enough, we're barely going to scratch the surface with three free sessions, but what are we meant to do with that? We need much more holistic approaches to supporting our wellbeing. We need our organisations to actually act like they care. They need to reach into us. You know, if we get a bulk email with the number to an EAP, just so our organisation can basically tick off and say, yep, we support wellbeing, we know that that's disingenuous to us. We don't feel like they actually care about us. And what was really sad was that about 5% of the people that we spoke to had actually planned their suicide, and one actually spoke to us about how she had actually attempted suicide. And so that was really quite, you know, and yes, we only spoke to 60 of the many, many thousands of volunteers out there who had responded to those fires. It was really quite telling that wellbeing and mental health is a real concern amongst our volunteer firefighters, and we're just not doing enough to support those who go out and look after our communities when, you know, these bushfires are raging. So we can do better, and we must do better.
And so it was just volunteers you spoke with?
Yeah, so for this particular research project, it was just volunteer firefighters that we looked at.
And how did you recruit them?
So this was really tricky. We initially were thinking we were going to go out by the organisations. We learned pretty quickly that if we recruited formally through the organisations, that we weren't going to get people to want to speak to us because they were concerned that there wouldn't be anonymity and that the results would go back to the organisations. So we actually went out and recruited through what's called convenient sampling and then snowball sampling. So we went out through social media sites, we went out through groups that we knew we could actually reach volunteers, and then they actually then spoke to their mates and said, hey, I spoke to these people, if you want to have a say, get in contact with them. And so it was that kind of what we call snowball sampling. So they felt that they were freer to talk anonymously and honestly to us without any kind of repercussions from their organisations.
I can see that, yeah, that research is really interesting. I've been recently reading the After the Fires research by, you know, led by David Lawrence and the team at University of Western Australia. I can see that you both looked at a similar issue and a similar cohort, a similar time in history. They've done it in that macro, that you know, quantitative, you know, looking at a survey, taking into account thousands and thousands of perspectives. And they, you know, it's a pretty damning report of the mental health impacts on the sector. What you've done, as I can see, is taken a small cohort and dug deeply into what those results might mean or feel like to the people. And as a result, you've created some really rich insights. And so what you were talking about before, which was the implication, you know, obviously as implications for the sector. And I did listen to your talk last night, a presentation you gave at a conference, and I was really struck by how people are not willing to go within their organisation to have help for reasons they want to be anonymous, and they don't, you know, really want it to backfire. They might not be able to get that, you know, work in an operational capacity if they go to their provider, you know, their EAP provider. So I guess I'm fascinated by this because this has huge implications for the sector. Do you want to talk about that? Like what does it mean if agencies can't provide, or that's not the only answer? to supporting the mental health, especially for the work ESF's doing, you know, external organisations like us?
Yeah, so the work that we did absolutely echoed those findings of that much larger research project. So we were quite happy with that, that we were sort of, you know, replicating in a way and strengthening their findings as well using more of our qualitative methodology. But I think, yeah, it's really important for the sector to realise that this is not a one-off finding, and it's really important for them to realise that these people, they're not comfortable going to the organisation for support. And many, many of the people that we spoke to, many of the volunteers we spoke to, when we asked them why, the findings were clear, because they felt that it would be either career limiting or career ending. And some of the quotes were quite damning, in that one person actually said they went to their team leader and spoke to them about their mental health and wellbeing, and they were basically told that if they didn't man up, so to speak, that they would have their uniform taken off them. That if they couldn't hack it, then they shouldn't be doing the job. And they were like, but I'm volunteering. You know, it's this absolute mindset around, you know, yeah, if you can't hack it, you shouldn't be doing it. And that's, we certainly see that in career, the paid emergency service roles as well. And it's so disappointing that we still have that stigma out there as well. And the problem is, we saw this within the 2018 Beyond Blue National Survey as well, is that the stigma is still there as a problem, but this self-stigmatisation is still a huge issue as well. And so how do we address that, and how do we break that down? And I think you guys with ESF and the pilot program are world-leading, absolutely world-leading, not just within Australia, but in terms of breaking that down and actually equipping managers and leaders with the skills to actually change that, to actually have safer conversations, to actually provide psychologically safe organisations and workplaces, so that people will feel safer to go to their leaders, to go and have these conversations. And I think one of the key takeaways from our research is that what works is peer support. It's the sharing of lived experiences with people who get it. They don't want to ring up and talk to a stranger at the end of an EAP line who just doesn't understand. They want to sit around and talk, whether it's in small groups or bigger groups, one-on-one, with someone who's been there and seen it and smelt it and understands it. They don't want to be with Erin, someone.
On the podcast, people can't see me smiling, but, you know, as the CEO of ESF, I'm sitting here beaming, hearing what you're saying, not only about our Leading for Better Mental Health program, but unbeknownst to you, we're developing a program at the moment called Let's Talk. And that is exactly what you're talking about. It's about bringing people together with their peers, with some support, to actually talk and debrief in an anonymous sort of a way, but also including their family. So brilliant. I feel really pleased that, you know, we are actually on the front foot here and responding to the sort of research that you're doing.
Great.
Because it's not just about, you know, that sitting down and talking to a psychologist is not for everyone.
You're so right, Sarah. And that's one of the things that came out of this as well. When we asked the 60-odd volunteers in our study, what could we do better? What would have worked for you? Because we know after COVID and with the bushfires, and because COVID was obviously a unique, confounding challenge that we threw at our volunteer firefighters after Black Summer. And we know the government did their best, and they threw millions of dollars, and there was telehealth, and there was more psychologists. And they were like, but I don't want to talk to a psychologist. That's not what would work for me. And what was really interesting as well is that the peer supporters, they weren't classified as essential workers. So they couldn't go out into the communities and sit down face-to-face and have a cuppa or have a beer with the people in their local communities. So I think where the money would have been better spent in some portions, in some areas, would have been in empowering people in the local communities to actually do peer support.
That's exactly what our Let's Talk program is about.
Yeah.
It's sort
of empowering the locals to do it so that if they're cut off, if they're isolated, they don't need to try to access psychologists. If they've lost their home and they don't have a phone or a computer, they don't have to worry about trying to get onto telehealth. They can go down to the local church or the local town hall, and they've been empowered and they can engage in local peer support and they can help themselves. That's what they want. That's what works. And that's what we took away from this project, is that when it came down to it, that's what really helped themselves, is being able to get together and share their stories. It was the storytelling and the sharing of the lived experience. It wasn't the EAP. It wasn't the fancy psychologist at the end of the day. They play their role, but what really helped was that intimate narrative, that storytelling, and they really wish their organisations would have just got that and got down there and helped that and sent some people out to do some peer support, and they would have actually felt better for it, and they would have actually stopped losing some of these volunteers who'd spent big, significant chunks of their time and their life and the generations, you know, their dads had done it, their grandfathers had done it, but based on their experience after Black Summer, they'd left their role and they won't come back.
That absolutely makes my heart swell, Erin. That we are on the right track. I feel very, very pleased about that.
So, Erin, your new role, trauma and journalism. Why does that interest you? Really excited about where you're going now. I'm sidestepping
a little bit out of the emergency services first responder role that I've been so passionate about the past two decades, but I'm not saying goodbye to that forever. I will certainly still be, you know, keeping tabs on that and hoping that I can still be working with you amazing people with ESF and keeping tabs on all of that. But this opportunity came my way, and it just, you know, sometimes the universe sends you a sign and sends you an opportunity that's too good to be true. And the opportunity came along to become the CEO for the DART Centre for Journalism and Trauma. And essentially everything that I've been doing for so long within the first responder emergency service world, journalists and those on the front line in conflict and disaster and war, you can imagine they suffer exactly the same kind of exposure and cumulative exposure to trauma as our first responders do and those on the front line. And so I'm going to be taking my skill set and my passion for protecting
and your lived experience
and my lived experience and taking it to a different kind of frontline cohort in terms of journalists and photographers and those on the front line in terms of you know, protecting them from trauma. But also the other aspect of it is educating around interviewing sensitively survivors of trauma and conflict and disaster, because that's always been one of my, you know, pet peeves as well, is that when we see trauma and disaster unfolding, you know, and then there's the journalist that gets up there and puts the microphone right in a survivor's face, and you know, yes, it's so important to be able to capture these events as they unfold, but there's a sensitive and ethical way to do that. So I feel like now I have an opportunity to be able to, you know, be at the forefront of making sure we can do that sensitively as well. So that's my new role.
We've come a long way, Erin, because when I was at CFA 20 years ago, I introduced the program for the media about physical safety of the media, you know, and they wear the protective clothing now and they're trained up to sort of go on the fire ground from a safety perspective. But, you know, it was just 20 years ago. We never really even thought of the mental health impact on those people or on anyone else, or how they sort of dealt with survivors. You know, innately we knew it wasn't right, but nothing was really done with it. So we've come a huge way, and I think you are a great person to sort of align what you know of disaster management and recovery with the work of journalism. I think it's an inspired choice by the people to choose you for that role, and I'll say congratulations. Look, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today, Erin. You know, we could go on for hours, but let's do that over lunch instead.
So,
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Sarah.
And thank you for listening to this Emergency Service Foundation Better Together podcast, which aims to provide you with insights about mental health and wellbeing from experts, thought leaders, and people on the ground. If you want to know more about what we do, or better still, support our work, please go to esf.com.au.